I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to be talking about the Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. I wish I had my mother's brass candlesticks brought from Scotland to America when she was 16. She gave them to a neighbor as a thank you for something or other. Do you have something from a relative or an antique with history that matters to you? Later in the show, I'll invite you to call and tell me about it. Objects from the past have all kinds of meaning. It makes sense. They can be weird or valuable. People collect ice cube trays. One man I know collects toothpaste tubes from different countries. The Smithsonian Institution and its museums has been collecting things for a long time. They have, are you ready for this, 137 million items now. And then the Smithsonian, Under Secretary for History, Art, and Culture, had an idea. Would it be possible to pick just 101 of the 137 million things to tell the history of America? How would you do that with just 101 things? And that's just what Richard Curran and staffers did, bound to start a spirited conversation about what got in, what was excluded and should be in there. But that's the point. Agree or disagree, the book about the 100 or so items selected is interesting, if not at times fascinating reading, a fun way to learn history. Just to have a book at your fingertips that you can pick up and put down and learn a little something in the process. The book and exhibit is called The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. I have loved dipping into this, especially the story about our flag, the Star-Spangled Banner. From the early 1800s. How did the Smithsonian end up getting the Hope Diamond? We're going to find out. Richard Curran, welcome to the show.
And it's good to be here, Faith.
Oh, it's what a, congratulations on this. What an effort this is.
Well, just like you learned, I learned by doing this. You know, the scope of history is broad, and there's a lot of neat stuff in the Smithsonian.
It's just endless when you think about 137 million items, and more coming in all the time, because, as you say, the events of today are the history of tomorrow. Tell me about your feelings on the meaning of objects that were there at the time.
Objects are important to us because I think they encapsulate history. They were there at that particular time. So, you know, look, why do millions of people go to museums? You go to museums to see the real thing, to connect to those objects, to connect to an object of beauty in an art museum or history, and really feel what it was like at that time and imagine what it was like. So I think for millions of people who go to a museum, they understand objects. And as you say, and as you pointed out, you got a lot of people that collect because they're just fascinated by doodads and instruments and car parts and ice cube trays, all sorts of things.
I'm so interested to see how you and all your staffers decided to curate this and choose these particular items. So I'm looking at, this happened to me when I was in Nice. I went into Matisse's house, and as I was walking down the stairs, I thought to myself, I held on to the banister, I thought, he did this. He touched this banister. I couldn't get over it. So I'm now looking at Louis Armstrong's trumpet. And you have it. This is from, from 1928?
Actually 1930s, yeah.
Okay. And tell me the story of how you got this trumpet.
Well, actually, this is one that we got. We got this through his manager. And, these trumpets were made really for him. He ended up endorsing the trumpets because he found the sounds of the Semler trumpet were just so pure with him. So he was originally given one of these kind of trumpets when he performed in England, in London, and left the United States. It was in the mid-1930s. And after that, this particular brand of trumpet became known as the Louis Armstrong model. His manager gave it to us. as part of a donation for the new African American History and Culture Museum that we're now building on the Mall. In doing that museum, we are now acquiring, we're going from zero in a collection to about 25,000 items, and we're telling the story of everything from, you know, slavery and emancipation, items of Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, to the making of America's music, which really is jazz as a unique form that was that Louis Armstrong helped not only summon those creative currents that were in New Orleans and in the United States, a wonderful mixture of African-American and Anglo-American and other, the cultural melange of New Orleans, but a music that's now been given to the world and gone around the world.
Listening to that, you can hear, I'm glad you selected him, because there is an ability he has to phrase, you know, the way he slides. Some people are able to do this in their reading and their singing. Ella Fitzgerald did this, where, you know, the jump to the next sentence isn't where you think it's going to go, and it's gorgeous musically the way it's done.
Yeah, and I think many people drew inspiration. I mean, you know, Armstrong's, you know, type of jazz, you know, really crossed over to so many people. I think that was the, you know, one of the things was that it really had such broad appeal across the board to so many.
Let's do, you have Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Fireside Chat Microphone. I think this was, we're going to hear a few words as he spoke them over this same microphone. That was a CBS mic, right?
Yeah, we have two. We have a CBS mic, and we also have an NBC mic. And he had actually pointed out one of the issues. I mean, when you look at that microphone, I suspect the microphone that you are using today is quite a bit different. Roosevelt's microphones look pretty primitive by our standard, but, you know, remember, radio was just becoming really a public media from the kind of really the mid-20s. So when he's delivering the fireside chats in the 30s, it's pretty primitive. And Roosevelt actually commented on the microphone that we have in the Smithsonian because it was the Columbia Broadcasting System. He didn't know what CBS was. And just before the speech, he asked, now, what is this CBS?
This reminds me of Bush saying, what is this product code on these items? You know, we're using right now these beautiful, sleek, black Sennheiser microphones in our studio. And I feel like I want to say to Sennheiser, but when you look at that old school mic, it's such a beautiful object. I think somebody ought to do the engineering that we have now inside one of these old school mics. Let's listen to Franklin Roosevelt doing a little bit of a fireside chat.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking. To talk with the comparatively few who understand the mechanics of banking, but more particularly with the overwhelming majority of you who use banks for the making of deposits and the drawing of checks. I want to tell you what has been done in the last few days and why it was done and what the next steps are going to be. I recognize that the many proclamations from state capitals and from Washington, the legislation, the treasury regulations, and so forth, couched for the most part in banking and legal terms, ought to be explained for the benefit of the average citizen. I owe this in particular because of the fortitude and the good temper with which everybody has accepted the inconvenience and the hardships of the banking holiday. And I know that when you understand what we in Washington have been about, I shall continue to have your cooperation as fully as I have had your sympathy and your help during the past week.
That is from March 12th, 1933. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, fireside chat. That's that microphone that he used then is at the Smithsonian. And also in this book that we are talking about, Richard Curran's and company, The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. I think about people gathering around the radio, listening to that fireside chat at such an important time, 1933, and how with so few networks, we could do that kind of thing, everybody hearing the same thing.
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, you got to realize that now we take it for granted, but at that time, most Americans had never heard their president. And Herbert Hoover, who, you know, Roosevelt had succeeded, did try to do things on radio, but you know, radios were not of great quality. Again, they were just coming into prominence in the mid-20s. And Hoover did not sound very well. He didn't have a great voice for radio. His pacing was off and so on. You know, Roosevelt played the radio like Armstrong played the trumpet. He had a wonderful sense of the media. He was very clear. You know, when you listen to that fireside chat, you realize how kind of complex. I mean, this was not like an easy thing to explain. And Roosevelt was going on to a dissertation about banking. So, and explaining it to a wide swath of citizens of the United States. But for the most part, I think it was the fact that here was the president coming into your living room, as you say, all across the country. You felt the president was talking to you. And that's what the fireside chats did. Now, you know, Roosevelt himself remarked on the irony. I mean, fireside chats, you know, delivered March 12th, 1933. I didn't check the weather on that date, but Roosevelt himself joked about the idea that from Washington you'd be getting these fireside chats in the spring.
Yeah, I was thinking about how I had read an article by a political writer in The New Yorker who said that the State of the Union speeches, and a lot of people watch them, do absolutely nothing. That if you look historically at what happens as a result of those speeches, really not so much. And so, you know, it's interesting to see over time what's happened to the power of the presidency. I think that's what you're talking about here. I want to get to Woody Guthrie in just a second. But to go back to our earliest times, because you do start with what is your first object?
The first object in the book is the Burgess Shale.
That's it, yeah.
They're kind of the first Americans. Actually, they're kind of Canadian. They're very strong, very primitive organisms that exist in the what later becomes North America, and they're captured as fossils in shale up in the Pacific Northwest.
There's something about reading that really was so great, because you said, you know, if you at this time went up into the sky and looked down at Earth from space, you wouldn't see what we recognize now. There'd be oceans in all the wrong places and land masses connected that weren't. And it explains why when we go to the Midwest, we can find fossils of ocean creatures.
Yep, I've hiked up Mount Washington many times, and you get brachiopods and trilobites and all these creatures of the sea around the White Mountains. It's very interesting.
Okay, I can't wait to talk about the Star Spangled Banner. I love this story, and I know you do too. So we'll be right back. We're going to take a quick break and then talk some more about objects in the Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. Richard Curran is my guest. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. Right now, we have Richard Curran, who's author of The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. This is also an exhibit that you can see. But, Richard, I have to tell you, this is like having you on the show is a lot like finding out where you've been seated at the best dinner party. And I end up in a chair next to you and I happen to say, so what have you been up to lately? And there it goes. And I am, fascinated and entertained all night long. So this is really fun. Star Spangled Banner. I knew something about the history of this, but reading your comments here, your brief history of this is just amazing. How much money? This is the flag that hung in. Let me see. Was it 1812?
It was 1814. It 14, was the War okay. of 1812, but it hung. It was flown over Fort McHenry in Baltimore when the British were trying to take over the United States. So it was 1814.
And huge, we should say, I think. And so there is a picture. I'm not sure how much money has been spent over time trying to preserve this flag. How many millions?
Oh, I don't know, probably about $30 million or so.
There is a picture of this Anita Fowler's team working on the flag in 1914, trying to restore it in a giant hangar-type place, it seems like. And then there is a team of conservators, a photograph of a team of conservators working on the flag's restoration in 1999, lying on a board on their stomachs, doing this tiny, tiny work on this massive, massive thing that is made out of wool, correct?
Yes, yeah.
And who's the woman who did this at first? This came. Her whole family did all kinds of patriotic things. Who was this woman?
Right. Well, this was a woman who had made had made flags, had made uniforms. During the Revolution, this is Mary Pickersgill and her family, and they had sewn flags and uniforms for George Washington's army, back in 1776 at that time. So they were making flags, and this was 30 feet by 42 feet, and I think the flag cost a little over $400 to make. It was ordered by Armistead, who was the he was the commanding officer, Major Armistead of Fort McHenry, and he wanted to make a big American flag to fly it in the face of the British to say, we are here.
Uh-huh.
And they saw him, and they sent those rockets' red glare and the bombs bursting over air in September of 1814 to knock down that flag, knock down the fort, and take over Baltimore. And had they done that, the United States would have been a very different country. The British had already burnt the White House. They burnt the Capitol. They had invaded Washington in August. And Baltimore was really a hub of privateers and people that were very pro-U.S. at the time. You know, it was a center of commerce for the whole mid-Atlantic region, certainly the Chesapeake Bay. And so here was this big flag sticking in their eye, and they wanted to take it over.
You say in your story here connected to the flag that you have personally been asked to take all kinds of world leaders to see this flag.
Yeah, I mean, people from the Senate, presidents of the United States, other world leaders, because a lot of people from the rest of the world never quite realize how fragile the United States was as a young country. You know, often they're dealing with, particularly in, many parts, many of the younger countries of Africa and Asia, often dealing with instabilities and the building of nationhood, and they don't quite realize how fragile the United States was at the beginning of its history. Many Americans don't realize that.
Mm-hmm. And do you see them affected by that story, by seeing that?
Oh, totally. Look, the country we just got over, the world just got over watching, several weeks of the Olympics. Watching, an American flag going up and hearing the Star Spangled Banner. And I doubt whether, more than a handful really understand that song is about the particular flag that we have saved at the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
They came to us almost a century after it had flown. But when we sing about, that flag, the Star Spangled Banner, we're talking about that particular flag that flew over that fort and had Francis Scott Key not seen it in dawn's early light, we wouldn't have had a country the way we do now.
I'm looking at this Mississippian Birdman copper plate, and I was so amazed and fascinated reading your essay about this. This is, I know I'm going out of order historically, and so this might be a little head snapping, but it's, you know, these are so interesting to me, and we have sound connected with some of these. This Birdman copper plate, you said that there were places here in North America where Native Americans and others had these mounds that were built, and that this was the tradition of these earlier civilizations, North American Native civilizations, these mounds. And one of these mounds, I forget where you said, had a population to rival London. I was so shocked by that. And not only this copper plate, which is gorgeous, that they made, but all kinds of things. Tell me about this.
Yeah, well, when Europeans first came to North America, they did not find, apparently, you know, any evidence of large-scale, you know, urban civilization. Now, people then later on found stuff, certainly, you know, conquistadors and others were aware of Inca and Aztec civilizations, and then later became aware of Mayan civilizations. But in North America, it was pretty much thought that, Native people had not really risen to the level of, developing cities and large-scale society. All around the United States, particularly in the Southeast, if you come from the Mississippi River eastward, and particularly in the Southeast, you find all sorts of mounds in, you know, Georgia and Tennessee and even Ohio. And people would find evidence of artifacts from them, and they weren't quite sure. But the mounds clearly were not just natural. They were made as a result of, having some type of habitations and buildings under it. The biggest area was really Cahokia.
Mm-hmm.
It's right near St. Louis in Illinois. It's, right by the Mississippi River there. And this was a huge mound. The mound itself represented a habitation probably as big as the Great Pyramid of Egypt, the biggest mound. And that was one of dozens and dozens of mounds in the area. So archaeologists think the city may have been 25,000, maybe up to 40,000 people living in a city, you know, sometime around 1100 A.D. And that really was something that people, you know, the early colonists and so on could not fathom. But at Cahokia, it was a multi-ethnic society. They were very sophisticated. And one of the things that we think they used copper, and they manufactured the bird plate that you're talking of, is exquisite artwork.
Mm-hmm.
It really is amazing. And, you know, when you look at it and you say, my, the craftsmanship, the artistry, you cannot but doubt that Native people had what, you know, we would call civilization.
Yeah.
But that early colonists discounted.
1300 A.D. Amazing. All right, you are involved in this Woody Guthrie thing. We have a little bit of this original recording. Tell us the story first.
Well, you know, Woody Guthrie is, growing up as a kid, you know, everybody sings, you know, "This Land Is Your Land." And that was a song that was put together by Woody Guthrie back in 1940. And, war clouds were over Europe. Bess Smith had been doing God Bless America. And Guthrie wanted something that spoke to the soul of the country. Now, Guthrie had been traveling around. He was a child of the Dust Bowl. You know, he was riding the rails. He was, experienced America at the grassroots. He was pretty left-leaning, but he was also very, you know, he was a populist. And he traveled the country, so he knew of what he spoke. So when he wrote, what came to be known, at first he called it God Blessed America, and he kind of crossed that out of the title. He wrote it in 1940 in New York. But he did not sing it until years later when he sang it in the studio and recorded it for Mo Ash, a New Yorker who was to start Folkways Records.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that grabbed it. Other people thought Pete Seeger, who just passed away. Pete
yeah.
was a a good friend and good colleague of ours. You know, Pete thought it was a very simple tune, but that simplicity really resonated. And I think many Americans sing it as kind of an alternative anthem of the country. It really speaks to many people.
There is something, sly, it's almost cynical as a word, but I can't help it. Sly in this idea that this land is your land. I think we can sometimes get mixed up with powerful people being what they are. We think somebody else owns this place. And so I think it was actually a very political song in its simplicity. Let's listen a little bit to this recording from 1945.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless skyway, I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
It's interesting, 1945. I know you helped with it. What was it, the reissue of this recording?
Well, we Mo Ash was elderly and ran Folkways, from the 40s through the 80s. And, you know, it was like kind of a one-man operation. People would send him recordings, and he recorded Guthrie hundreds of hours, Pete Seeger hundreds of hours. But it was a very small operation, and he wanted to preserve that whole idea of documenting people's music from all over the world, all over the United States, at the grassroots, not big commercial music, but everybody's voice. And so the Smithsonian approached him, said we would like to save the archives and actually continue that work of documenting what people have to say and sing. And so we got Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen and U2 and a bunch of others, Emmylou Harris, Arlo Guthrie, Pete Seeger, to do a benefit album for us. It won a Grammy, and that paid for the Smithsonian to acquire it. And every year we're putting out, two dozen new recordings and making sure, and now, of course, over the web and iTunes and all this other stuff, but basically to keep that going so we could continue to publish the voices of the people.
Hey, so what has, you do address this a little bit in the book, but what has the internet done? What's the online world, the digital world done to what we might be collecting in the future? You know, have we lost our letters? Have we lost our written documents?
Well, I don't think so. And, in some ways you can look at it as making collection and creative activity much more democratic. I mean, Guthrie signed this simple contract with Mo Ash. very, very simple. Any business person for a record company would pale at the contract. But, for the longest time, you needed big companies to help you get your song out. And now anybody from around the country in a garage or somebody in the desert of Rajasthan can upload a recording digitally and have it be heard by people in Brazil and Australia.
Oh, I know.
And Canada, everywhere. It's great.
Oh, it's fantastic. I'm not knocking it. I'm just thinking about people who collect things as you do. Who writes letters anymore?
That's still happening. We're still collecting stamps at the Smithsonian, and we have a whole stamp museum with 6 million stamps in it.
Yeah.
And now that people can make their own stamps or digitally, you can become your own post office.
Yeah.
It's interesting when you look at the history of technology. We always think that something is going to put the other stuff out of business. Live musicians were very worried that,
right,
the recorder right. Would put people out of business, or that
and
radio
the book.
Would put people out of business.
What's,
yeah.
what's going to happen to the book? That's what. That's the
well,
new one.
Well, now we have Kindles, you know.
Yeah.
So, I, you know, it's you know, it, there are transformations. There's no question about it. I mean, new technology imposes transformations, and then people have a way of adapting and being creative in new media. We certainly see it in artwork, where you know you used to have to make a painting. Now, you know, then we had photography, and people were making photographs as artwork, and now, of course, people are using all sorts of digital media to express their creativity. And the Smithsonian and other museums are collecting that. Now, the challenge for us, of course, is when we collect it, and, you know, collecting, having Guthrie's material, and we have material on songs of Native Americans, on cylinder recording, on wire, on tinfoil, on cardboard, all these media that we use. What you have to do if you're a museum and you're going to keep it up is you have to also collect the technology that played it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a challenge.
Yeah. This is Richard Curran. He is the Smithsonian's author of the Smithsonian's History of America and 101 Objects, the book. And as we go to a break right now, we're going to hear Johnny B. Good. And this relates to an object that you have in the collection. Want to just mention it quickly? Chuck Berry's Gibson, right? Gibson
Chuck
guitar?
Gibson guitar, or one of the guitars that he affectionately called Maybelline.
Yeah, we're gonna hear that. And we'll be right back. And then I want to talk about the Hope Diamond, how you found it, how it got there. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. And as we continue our conversation, I want to say thanks to our producing staff, Jonathan McNichol and Lori Mack, and tell you that my guest is Richard Curran, who is author of the book, The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. This is also an exhibit. Let me just do a little bit of a list of some of the objects in here. I'm going to whip through these. The Burgess Shale fossils, the bald eagle, Clovis stone points, those are the hunting tools from 13,500 years ago. We talked about that copper plate, the Christopher Columbus portrait, a Spanish mission hide painting of St. Anthony, Pocahontas's portrait, Plymouth Rock fragment, shackles that were used on slaves, actually used, the America Nova Tabula map, the Declaration of Independence, George Washington's uniform and sword, Benjamin Franklin's walking stick, the Star-Spangled Banner we mentioned, Thomas Jefferson's personal Bible, the a Conestoga wagon, Eli Whitney's cotton gin, John Deere's steel plow, Isaac Singer's sewing machine, Lewis and Clark's pocket compass, the John Bull steam locomotive, Samuel Colt's revolver, the Morseville telegraph, a Mexican army coat, a gold discovery flake, a piece of gold from Sutter's Mill, Martha the last passenger pigeon, Frederick Douglass's ambrotype portrait, Harriet Tubman's hymnal and shawl, the Emancipation Proclamation pamphlet, Christian Fleetwood's Medal of Honor, that was the highest military honor, of course, awarded to an African-American soldier during the Civil War, and it helped integrate the U.S. National Museum decades later. And we'll go on with some more things in this book and in the exhibit. So the Hope Diamond, how in the world did you acquire this?
From a man named Harry Winston.
Yeah, what a thing.
Packed it up. It is placed on Fifth Avenue in New York, and an ex-policeman walked it over to the, took the subway, went to the General Post Office, and put it in the mail.
Unbelievable.
November 1958, and a few days later, it arrived at the Smithsonian.
And was it your idea was it your invitation that he considered this, or was it his idea?
No, well, he was looking to do it, and he got into a little argument with the Natural History Museum in New York, and the Smithsonian really wanted to begin a national collection. And Harry was a pretty chauvinistic guy. He collected large and big diamonds. He sold them. But he started something like the Court of Jewels. And after World War II, he looked at the United States and he said, you know, since we never had a real king and queen, I mean, since we were an independent country, we never developed the, you know, crown jewels like these other European countries. And we should have crown jewels. We're a world power, for God's sakes. And if the U.S. isn't going to do it, I'm going to do it. And so he gave the Hope Diamond to the country with the idea that it would provide the basis for starting a great national collection of gems.
Well, you know, right all by itself, if you ever needed funding, emergency funding, you're all set, is what I say. Well, that is a thing, actually, that so many people make contributions to the Smithsonian. And the Smithsonian is actually many, many museums and thousands of employees. It's just a startling thing. Let's talk about among your favorite ways that something has gotten to the museum. Tell me one of your best stories.
Well, a few, you know, and some I've watched, you know, directly, you know, because I've worked at the Smithsonian. Well, started doing work here since the mid-1970s for the bicentennial of the U.S. But I think one of the dramatic things a few years ago was the delivery of the Space Shuttle Discovery.
I know.
Now, that didn't come through the mail like the Hope Diamond, which was pretty dramatic enough. The Space Shuttle Discovery, of course, came on the back of a specially fitted 747, and it flew around Washington. It flew up and down the National Mall of the United States, and literally millions of people got out of their homes, their cars, their offices to come out and watch the spectacle. And as my good colleague Jack Daly, who's the head of the Air and Space Museum, a general in his own right, said, he said, you know, you give a flyboy a crowd and they'll keep flying forever. But to see the shuttle delivered to Washington, the space shuttle coming over the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument, the U.S. Capitol, it was just really amazing.
I think about presidents fighting to get their hands on that for their museums. You know, that was quite a coup that you have that. Some more of the list from the book, and there are photographs of the paintings, the objects themselves, and to see the progress of the nation, to see what these things look like from the very beginning is just something. The Appomattox Courthouse furnishings, Abraham Lincoln's hat that he wore the night of his assassination at Ford's Theater, Alfred Bierstadt's Among the Sierra Nevada, California painting, American Buffalo. This was so important as an object to Native peoples, and bringing it back actually sparked the conservation movement. That's why it's included here. Sitting Bull's own drawing book, a bugle from the USS Maine, Alexander Graham Bell's telephone. That was when they were producing electric speech. Thomas Edison's light bulb. You know, that's a pretty great-looking object, that light bulb. You know, really, seriously. I was looking at it and thinking, studying how he did it, and it hasn't changed so much. I mean, we have these new light bulbs now, I know, but it stayed the way he did it for so long.
Well, and he brought in a professional glass blower. He brought in some of the best, you know, glass. I mean, there were, you know, the shape of the light bulb was arrived at through pretty rigorous experimentation. And, you know, because they had to create a vacuum, you know, so the idea was, you know, these had to be really these were crafted objects. They weren't just happenstance, and they were arrived at as through great experimentation.
Let's take a call. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, Faith.
Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
This goes back to the previous topic about recording. You know, the comment I think was to if we have all these great recordings, we need to keep up with the technology to play them. And it just reminded me that right here in Connecticut, we have a museum that does exactly that, called the Radio Communications Museum. It's in Windsor. And that was my thought. I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that. I've actually been in touch with them because I have some old radios, and so I know that place. Thank you for your mentioning. Let's go on a little bit. Let's do something from. I want to ask about Julia Child's Kitchen.
Okay.
And so I know you knew her, and I did too, and I know that when she left her home in Cambridge, for California. And, sold the home. She walked out the door. She promised herself she would walk out the door and not touch an item in that house. She wanted to see it one last time, just the way it was. And there you have, and I was in that kitchen. There you have her kitchen just as it was in your museum.
She was great. She was not only a fantastic cook that, transformed the way we think about food and, the whole idea about creativity and in the home and in the kitchen, but she would have made a great curator of a museum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
So much thought went into everything in that kitchen. And when when we had first heard that, her husband Paul had passed away and Julia was going to retire to Santa Barbara. We had thought, people said, well, this should be in the Smithsonian something. And, we didn't know what. And our curators that went up there, Raina Green and Paul Johnson, Nancy mm-hmm. Davis, beginning talks with her. I think the original idea was, well, maybe we'll get the Garland stove and we'll take a few of, her implements from France and, a few things. And as they did work in the kitchen and talking to Julia Child, they realized the immense significance of everything. And, of course, it was used. The house kitchen was used, for several years for her GBH show. And so they started getting the sense, no, this all ties together. This is all systematic. This goes together. We can't just take a few of this and a few of that. We have to take everything in the kitchen, including the kitchen sink.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what they did. And Julia Child helped document everything in that kitchen and really gave us a great sense of how she worked and how it worked.
And it is a great lesson when you see this kitchen that it's not fancy, that she didn't feel she had to have the latest everything. She had tried and true things, pots and knives and those of us who just keep redoing kitchens time after time and somehow think it's going to make you a better cook, I'm not so sure. I think Julia was a great lesson about that.
No, it was great. I mean, she had, obviously electronic mixing bowls, but she also had a traditional mortar and pestle.
Yeah. Let's hear a little of her, just for the fun of it.
Bœuf bourguignon, French beef stew in red wine. We're going to serve it with braised onions and mushrooms and a wine dark sauce. It's a perfectly delicious dish. Hello, I'm Julia Child. Welcome to The French Chef and the first show on our series on French cooking. We're going to make bœuf bourguignon, beef stew and red wine. And it's a wonderful show to begin our series on because it shows you so many useful things about French cooking. How to brown meat, how to braise onions, how to sauté mushrooms, how to make a wonderful sauce, and you make a bœuf bourguignon just the way you make any other kind of a stew, like chicken coq au vin. You can make lamb this way or veal this way. And now here's our beef. And I've made quite a few beef stews lately getting ready for this program, and I've tried several different cuts, some from the leg called the top round and the bottom round, and from all the stews I've made, I find that I like chuck the best. So these are various pieces of chuck.
So smart. Such a smart thing. That is the tastiest part of the steer. Oh, so great to just hear her voice again. And also you can see from a little bit of formality from her right there that over time she began to loosen up and become more herself as her series went on. Let's go to the Ku Klux Klan robe and hood. As you point out, these were the disguises that these people resorted to so that they would not have to pay a price for the terror that they exhibited, and for generations, and still around.
Yeah, it's, you know, Ku Klux Klan has gone through several different incarnations since, you know, it was first, created, I suppose, you know, in the wake of the Civil War. And so, you know, it's been suppressed at different times. It's fallen out of favors. But, you know, it's, you know, one of those kind of organizations that unfortunately keeps rearing its head in American life. It's, you know, kind of the underside of, you know, what's so great about our democracy and what's so great about, you know, our country in terms of, you know, open to all. And obviously the Ku Klux Klan is not open to all.
The you have a suffragist banner. And that brings me to something with regard, well, not just to women, obviously, but to the our men and women. And that is including the pill, the birth control pill.
Mm-hmm.
That is smart.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the suffragist banner is obvious, you know. You know, that goes back, you know, to pre-Civil War days when, you know, the idea of expanding American freedom and rights, you know, is being talked about both in terms of women's rights, but also those of black folks in terms of, you know, slavery. And this all seemed contradictory to the Declaration of Independence. And I think it's been instructive through our history that, you know, different groups, and it may be women, it may be African-Americans, it may be Chicanos, it may be folks with disabilities, that we maybe now, you know, gay rights, where you have issues of really realizing an American ideal about, you know, freedom and justice for all. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a continual theme that plays out, not without a great deal of struggle in our country over our history.
Yeah, and you have gay civil rights picket signs. So, and you say today's news events are tomorrow's history. And when I saw that you had these gay civil rights picket signs, that made me think about gay marriage.
Right.
And so I think, well, in the future, would we see, now that the president has the Supreme Court has done what it's done, would something connected with gay marriage end up in the Smithsonian, do you think?
Yeah, you know, marriage, you know, gay marriage certificates, you know, are very likely. I mean, I think I make the point, and you've made it, I think, quite well, that, you know, everything in the book at one point was news, not history.
Mm-hmm. Or controversial.
You know, I mean, everything in the book, you know, the pill wasn't created as a museum object. You know, it was created for a purpose, you know, for, you know, women and families, you know, to have control over their reproductive futures. And so everything is a news story. And when I look at the news that's being made today, I look at stuff and I say, okay, well, here, gay marriage, that's coming along. We should probably be collecting, you know, birth certificates. We have a rover on the Mars, right?
And you're going to get that, right?
I would love to get that. We actually have a Viking 1 on Mars that belongs to the Smithsonian. NASA gave it to us. And when you played Johnny B. Good, that's one of the songs that's on a special disc that went with Voyager that is actually now outside of our solar system.
Wow.
Heading into deep space.
Got to run. Richard, thank you. Yes. Thank you so much for being on the show. You are the best. Richard Curran, author of the Smithsonian's History of America and 101 Objects. You're the best. As always, this show is about the richness of life. You can find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.